Hi, everybody. I'm George Heffler, and you're listening to The Best Little Horror House in Philadelphia, the show where we talk about the best horror movie ever made, according to our guest, at least. And today's guest is Joe Kroll. How you doing, Joe?
Hey, George. How you doing, man?
Good, good. Happy to have you on. And Joe, tell me, are you a big horror fan?
Yeah, I try not to claim too much expertise when I haven't really poured in, you know, the thousands of hours and everything, but I've done the high hundreds of hours, I would say, and I'm into it in a big way.
That's awesome. That's awesome. What's your favorite, like, style of horror? Like, I know I love slashers and stuff. Some people are really into the supernatural stuff. What's your brand of horror?
Yeah, it's going to be horror with a bit of action to it. That's the stuff. Nice. I really like, which is one of the reasons why I'm bringing the movie today that I am.
Very cool. Very cool. And so you've been into horror for, you said, hundreds of hours. You're clearly a big fan. This is something that you got into as a kid, or is it more of a recent thing?
It's probably, I was maybe a little on the modest side for how much I've poured in, if you count books too. But when I was a little kid, I was terrified of everything. I definitely went to a friend's house when I was really tiny, and his older sister was watching Nightmare on Elm Street with her friends, and that messed me up pretty good.
I'm sure that's a messed up movie still.
But yeah, like after that, it was just, you know, vampires, zombies, werewolves, like any of that stuff in pop culture always like really gripped me. And then eventually I started reading the entry gateway drug of Goosebumps, and then eventually graduated to Stephen King at like fifth grade, and that probably was too soon, but I've been way into horror ever since.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think that Goosebumps, you're right, that it really was a huge gateway for a lot of kids, because it had just the right amount of spooks that you could.
Yeah, definitely. My favorite Goosebumps thing is when, you know, basically at the end of every chapter, it's like, and then there was some heavy breathing behind the door, and then he opens the door and it's like his baby sister or whatever. So never really paid off, but it was got you ramped up.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite Goosebumps that you remember? I know mine is, I remember really being fond of Say Cheese and Die, the one where take a picture and they would, everyone would wind up dead that you took a picture of.
I think I probably had a pretty legit pick back in the day that actually scared me, but anymore I think as like a nostalgic sort of fond memories thing, Night of the Living Dummy is such a stupid premise that I love it dearly.
Yeah, stone cold classic. All right, so without any further ado then, we'll start talking about the movie. And the movie that you picked today, the best horror movie of all time, is Green Room from Jeremy Saulnier.
That is now correct. And I do have to apologize to Jim Cameron, to Cronenberg, all the great directors from before. Unfortunately, you do have to eat my butt. The best movie that was ever made in horror was in 2015.
It's true. You know, it's everything's been leading up to that point. And for those of you who haven't seen it, we are going to be talking about spoilers, but just to give you a little synopsis, a punk rock band from Virginia, the DC area, they're forced to fight for survival after witnessing a murder at a neo-Nazi skinhead. Now,
that's right.
I hear people out there already saying, oh, that doesn't sound like a horror movie. That's, you know, just an action movie. And I know why I think that this is a horror movie. But, Joe, tell me, what's your opinion on what makes this a horror movie? Because it's very grounded in reality, unlike a lot of maybe like more typically movies that are associated with horror.
Yeah, for sure. It is definitely grounded and it is very realistic. I think that's kind of one of the reasons why it is so terrifying. We'll get to the, you know, plot synopsis later on, but basically for me, the first time I saw it, you know, in about 20 minutes in, they're playing this punk song about, you know, telling Nazis to fuck off in front of a bunch of Nazis, and just how that was shot, the concept of being surrounded by all these people in hostile territory, just terrifying. Like when I first saw it, it really jarred me and started freaking me out. So yeah, it's that thing of being faced with sort of overwhelming odds by truly evil people.
Yeah, and that's it, is that these people are straight up Nazis. There's white power stuff all over the place in the movie. There's the Confederate flag. People have SS tattoos. And right. I think that the fact that it is so real is part of what makes it so horrific. Because this is not, you don't, at the end of the day, you don't have to worry about running into Jason Voorhees. You don't have to worry about Black Phillip coming up to you and asking if you want some butter. But in today's day and age,
I prefer Black Phillip to these guys.
Yeah, exactly. In today's day and age, you really got to worry about Nazis. They're real. Yeah. They're out there. They're getting more and more popular, which is truly disgusting. And it's the fact that it's so grounded in reality is definitely, I think, a huge part of what makes this so horrific, in addition to the overwhelming odds that this poor band is facing.
Right, yeah. I know that we talk about the pitch for why this is the best ever toward the end of the show, so I'll save most of that for then. But for sure, personally, I live in Portland, Oregon. This movie was shot in Portland and areas around it. So, you know, this is pretty close to home for a number of reasons. And yeah, it's absolutely terrifying. On top of that, probably the best protagonist in the movie is a drummer, and that's also terrifying.
It's true. And yeah, definitely, I think the fact that you're in Portland in that area probably plays a big part of it. In real life, there was the Northwest Territorial Imperative. In the 1970s, there was a white separatist neo-Nazi idea where they were like, all white people got to just move up to like a little five-state region in the Northwest. I think it was Washington, Idaho, Oregon, Wyoming, and Montana, I want to say, is the last one. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea was that they would just secede from the U.S. and create their own Aryan nation. And this is a real thing that real Nazis really wanted to do. So there's definitely a sort of entrenchment of white supremacy, not just across the U.S., but particularly in that region, which can make it extremely frightening, again, tying into how realistic this movie is.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it dates back, obviously, the history of white supremacy is a, humanity long story. But in this particular case, in this particular region, Oregon's Constitution in 1857 actually included in the Bill of Rights that essentially no non-white person would be permitted to live within Oregon's borders. It was expressly an anti-slavery state, but it was also expressly a white supremacist state. And I guess that was kind of what they figured was being high-minded at the time.
Yeah, pretty crazy. Yeah,
the roots are very deep here. Obviously, I think, Portland and maybe Oregon in general is kind of viewed as more of a progressive state and progressive area. I will say that things have gotten a little better since 1857, but, we still have those roots and those kinds of people and thinking all over the place. And, it wasn't just a couple of years ago that one of these guy with these sorts of motivations and philosophies, if not an outright sworn member of a neo-Nazi group, stabbed two men trying to defend a Muslim woman on a train here in Portland. I mean, it is all over the place, and it's kind of insidious the way it's able to hide in broad daylight.
Yeah, and that's definitely something we'll chat about as we get into it. There's a lot of that sort of insidiousness where they kind of cover things up a little bit with, irony and language that's meant to kind of make it hard to figure out exactly what they're saying. And it's frightening. Now,
yeah, it's really tough.
I want to talk a little bit about the director and writer, Jeremy Saulnier. His stamp is all over this movie. It's a lot of it is taken from his own life. He grew up in Alexandria, Virginia. He was a skate kid and then became a punk rocker in D.C., much like the Ain't Rights, which is the name of the band in question in this movie. And I was reading an interview with him, and he said that he wanted to make this movie because he knew that he wouldn't be offered the chance to make this movie as ultra-violent and bleak as he wanted. No novice filmmaker would be given this chance. So he needed to time it just right, where he needed to have some success, but not so much success that they would be like, no, we're not going to put you on this story.
That's right.
So after Blue Ruin, which is another amazing movie of his, that was his sophomore effort, he decided the time was right to make Green Room. And thankfully he did. I don't think that this story could be made without his personal imprint on it, because it is so much based on him. Paintball story that Pat tells as a motivational tool is a real experience that Jeremy Saulnier had. Rick Spears is a real person who did exactly what they say in the story. And that kind of honesty, I think, is really present in the film and is part of what makes it so good.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one of the things that I saw when I was looking up interviews with him was him saying that he wanted a lasting record to show that he was, in fact, hardcore. And it doesn't get much more hardcore where he comes from in terms of like the music scene. And, you know, also regionally, it can be pretty difficult out in the DC and Virginia area, but that's the birthplace of hardcore. And he's got a big legacy to live up to. And I think he does a pretty damn good job in the movie.
Yeah, I definitely can't disagree. Let's talk a little bit about the cast as well.
Yeah, great cast.
It's an amazing cast, and everyone is really acting their asses off in it. Anton Yelchin is the star. He plays Pat, and boy, what a shame that we lost Anton Yelchin, because he is so good in not only this movie, but in a lot of movies. He's amazing in Thoroughbreds. He was a fun Chekhov in Star Trek, and he was really on the upswing. And unfortunately, for those of you who don't know, he was killed in a way that could have been prevented. It was the gear shifter in his Jeep Grand Cherokee. Negative shout out to Jeep.
Yeah.
The shifter showed that it was in park, but it was actually in neutral. And so it rolled back and pinned him against his gate. And he died like that.
Jesus, yeah.
It's really an awful. What a waste of talent. And you know, R.I.P. to Anton Yelchin. But he's not the only one who does great in this. Aaliyah Shawkat, who is most known.
Oh, George, you just gave me such a gift.
Oh.
Yeah. Against all odds, I found out that her name is pronounced Aaliyah Shawkat.
Oh my God! Wow. I stand corrected. So.
Yeah. No, I couldn't believe it either.
Yeah, Aaliyah Shawkat plays Sam, who is really awesome in this as well. She was the character of Sam was originally intended to be a man, but when she came in to audition for it, Jeremy Saulnier was so impressed that he gave it to her. And the rest of the band is rounded out by Joe Cole, who played Reese, and Callum Turner, who plays Tiger.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Every one of these guys is really bring in their best. And I love the fact that, you know, Aaliyah was able to step into this role, and you have no idea whatsoever that it was written, you know, originally written for a man. There's nothing to give any of those signifiers. Everybody here is playing their own instruments. Everybody, you know, Joe Cole learned how to play drums specifically for this. Anton Yelchin was already a pretty accomplished musician in his own right, although he would deny that himself if he were here. So it's just this very cool core group of young actors coming together and just ripping into the material, which gives them a lot to work with.
And they also, it would be very easy for someone who's writing this movie to sort of create the band as one entity and then just like distribute tasks for each individual member to do. But everyone really has their own personality in this. They all are totally unique.
I'm smiling right now as you're talking about it, like just thinking about some of these, just how well detailed they are.
Absolutely. At one point, right in the beginning, Joe Cole is called Jiu-Jitsu, and you don't know why. And then later, when he gets Eric Edelstein, who's playing Big Justin, who is sort of an enforcer for the Nazis, he puts him into an armbar, and it really, like, totally fucks him up.
Oh, yeah. No, his ability, his facility with like mixed martial arts and specifically jiu-jitsu is a huge part of the movie. And you wouldn't know it. He's just sort of facetiously called this thing because he like it's a little aggro with the dude early in the movie. And then, it's like this little seed that gets planted that later on actually pays off.
Right. Totally. It blossoms, that seed. And that sort of payoff is something that I think is really present in all of Jeremy Saulnier's movies.
Yeah.
The cast is sort of rounded out by Macon Blair, who plays Gabe. Macon is a huge part of Jeremy Saulnier's movies. He is the star of Blue Ruin. He is in Hold the Dark. And I believe that he's also helped out with some of the writing in a few of these movies. And he's wonderful in this movie, although it is a little bit of a smaller role. And of course,
a very pivotal one, though.
Yes, absolutely. Not to take away from his role. It's very pivotal. It's great. He does great in it. And it's obvious that he is sort of torn between fully investing in this Nazi collective and trying to not. He literally says in the movie, he's like, I don't want to go to jail. he kind of torn between these two worlds. And he does a great job of presenting that and sort of just going with the flow of the movie. He's just doing what people tell him to do. And
it's
I think
a really
that,
tough needle thread, yeah, where he's showing that he's reluctant to be involved, but at the same time, like, he's going to do some of these monstrous things anyway. Exactly. And for the audience to have any kind of goodwill toward him by the end, and I think you do come around a little bit. It's just, it's a really fantastic job, and, you know, I think a lot of it is down to not only skill, but just, you know, charisma.
I agree, and I think that portrayal is very realistic to me, where I think a lot of these people who turn to white supremacy and stuff, they're looking for someone to tell them what to do. They're a little aimless, right. They're lost, they're drifting. And so for somebody who has charisma and sort of a power of presence to come along and say, you're one of us and here's all you have to do, it's very realistic. And I think that Macon does a great job of portraying that.
Yeah, for sure. And it also doesn't get much more charismatic than the head honcho here in this movie.
That's right. And so speaking of, the head honcho is Patrick Stewart himself playing Darcy.
It's incredible.
Definitely not a role that a lot of people saw for him. He's obviously in Star Trek The Next Generation. He's done a lot of stuff as a hero character. And for him to take this turn and be really just this cruel and calculating neo-Nazi head is not only baffling in a good way, but it really gives you a whole new appreciation for his roles, I think. His range is on full display here, in my opinion.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this is literally the antithesis of the character he's been playing for the last, you know, 19 years or whatever with Professor Xavier. Shout out to all my X-Men fans. Oh, yeah. But yeah, here he is in, you know, pretty much every major movie he's been in. You know, the role that most people probably know him if you're under a certain age. Don't get into Star Trek in a real big way. And that role is entirely about unity across gender, preference, identity, all across all those lines. And here he is basically doing the evil Xavier complete with the goatee.
That's right. That's right. He does have a lovely goatee and is bald in both. So
correct.
I agree. And our last main character is Amber, played by Imogene Poots, which is one of my favorite names of all time. She's great. The murder that I mentioned at the beginning when I gave a little synopsis, she is friends with the woman who gets murdered. She's trapped in the room with the band. And although she says she's not a Nazi, but that she is sort of
white supremacist adjacent.
Yes, exactly. She sort of gets brought into the group just from the situation that they're all in. And she does a great job of, again, same thing with Macon Blair, of creating an empathy for this character that really doesn't necessarily deserve it.
Yeah, totally. I think she also deserves to be in the same conversation as Anton Yelchin in this particular comparison, because they're both doing a lot with other people around them with very high energy performances. Mm-hmm. Anton and Imogen are specifically very low energy and quiet in this movie, and they are still incredibly compelling, and they, you know, move the story along just sort of with the urgency and, you know, with acting with their eyes, with their facial expressions. It's pretty incredible to watch.
Yeah, and I think that energy that you mentioned there is very representative of the whole punk vibe that sort of permeates the movie. You know, there's these quick bursts of frenetic energy, and a lot of punk songs are a little on the shorter side, but they pack a lot in. And the movie itself is only 95 minutes, so it's relatively short. It's feature length, but, you know, these days that's short. The action sequences are very quick, but they're very powerful. So the whole thing sort of has this ethos of, you know, get the energy going, get it up, and then draw it back so that you're ready for the next one.
Yeah, it's hard, it's fast, it's visceral, and it's brutal. So it's all those things that, you know, like we were saying earlier on, Saulnier wanted to prove that he was hardcore, and he put his music and he put his philosophy from that era of his life on screen, both, you know, in terms of the metaphor of the movie itself, but also with the way he executed it.
As the band, they come to this venue, they, as you say, they play the Dead Kennedys song, Nazi Punks Fuck Off. It's
so awesome.
It's wonderful. It's very bold. And you get a little bit more characterization of not only the band, but individuals in the band. They reveal that Anton Yelchin's character is Jewish, which obviously would be an issue for the Nazis. And finally, they finish playing Nazi Punks Fuck Off. And they go to play their original song, Coronary. But you hear a little bit of it, and then it turns to sort of slow motion and classical music starts playing. That's music that we're hearing. Obviously, they're still playing their song. But it really reminded me of in Apocalypse Now when they're playing the Wagner and the operatic section. And it's really the whole idea is that it's about the spectacle. It's all a show. Right. And it's slow motion as they're moshing and throwing beer and jumping and playing music. And this whole performance is more than just the people on stage. It's the Nazis in the crowd posturing. It's the people who are there for real, who have committed murders. It's all
signified by wearing the right shoelaces or the red shoelaces.
Yes, exactly. For those who don't know, they sort of imply it in the movie, but color coordinated shoelaces, red shoelaces, are people who have committed an attack or shed blood for the skinhead movement. I know that color coordinated shoelaces were also used to differentiate between skinhead punks and skinhead Nazis, who are very different. And so that was sort of a way that they could differentiate themselves. All these little things that kind of add up to one big performance of the way that they're going through their life. It's really interesting.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if we're getting into plot right now, there's I think a little bit of setup that's worth talking about, because this band didn't just show up at the Nazi punk club out of nowhere.
That's right.
This band, who is very expressly, as evidenced by the fact they're seeing the dead Kennedys, Nazi punks fuck off, expressly opposed to Nazis. However, they're a band from, like you said, on the East Coast. They came all the way out to Oregon basically to do this show. Of a local promoter / journalist who basically didn't end up being able to come through on it. But, he has a way for them to get a little money so they can get back home in their beat up van. And the way they can do that is by playing this show closer to Portland, where I believe his cousin works.
Daniel.
At the club. Right. So this journalist, not only do we have the setup of why they're there, why they end up at this club that they'd be antithetically opposed to. Also, though, during that interview with the journalist, they do some more seating where he asks what their philosophy is about music. And it's what we were talking about already, where they answer it's being there in the moment. It's being there to experience it. The fast, the thrill of it, the visceral part of it. And then when it's over, it's over. And they don't really like recordings. They don't have any real social media presence. They are all about the live performance.
That's right. They say it's the texture. It loses the texture when you have a big social media presence and everything is recorded and you're constantly inundated with them. That's a really interesting philosophy. I know that I try not to take recordings and stuff when I'm at concerts, just because I really want to be there and be actually listening to it. So I definitely understand what they're saying.
For sure. Although I definitely shamefully do take video while I'm there, especially if I'm up in the balcony.
Oh, yeah.
And I got to tell you, the technology is fantastic. Really picks up the audio. I love it. I have a loving storage of a bunch of bands I've seen up here recently. So
that's awesome. Hey, look, just because I try doesn't mean I always succeed. And so speaking of, in this interview that they're doing with this journalist, he asks them a very important question, and it kind of comes up again throughout the movie. And the question is, what is your desert island band? And Joe, I got to know, what's yours?
Now, see, what I really loved about this movie when this question came up is that people were either conflicted openly, or they were posturing like they weren't conflicted about whatsoever and just choosing very cool answers. In that spirit, unfortunately, I wish I could do the same, but it's for me no question. It's Queens of the Stone Age. It's not even close.
Hey, it's a great band.
Yeah, huge breadth of work. I really like what they do. They have a lot of variation in what they do. But, if I had to pick a secondary one, let's do something fun like Janet Jackson or something.
Very nice. For yours truly, I had a similar thought pattern where I was like, I got to pick someone that's had a long career and they've shaken it up within that career. So you get a little bit of variation. And so my cool answer is Talking Heads.
Okay, nice.
My real answer that they would reveal at the end is Billy Joel.
Yes. If you did not say Billy Joel, I was going to kill you for it, man. That is, come on. That's your guy.
He's my guy. I can't deny it. Shout out to Billy. I spent a lot of time out in Long Island. So if you ever want to hit me up, Billy, we'll hang.
Do it.
And so the actual desert island bands, as they get revealed throughout the movie, like you said, they come out with their real answers that aren't just posture. It's Simon and Garfunkel, great band. Prince, also amazing. And then one of them says, still the Misfits.
Yeah, I love how, yeah, Tiger, the lead singer, remains true throughout. Like, answers immediately during the first part of the movie when he's being asked by the journalist. He's just like, yeah, Misfits. Yeah. And then later on, when everybody else has changed their answer, he's like, no, still Misfits.
Yes, that's right. It's true school, as they say.
Yeah.
And one thing that's kind of fun is that, to jump ahead a little bit, at the very end, the last line that Anton Yelchin says, and he says, I finally figured out what my Desert Island Band is, because he's unsure throughout the entire movie. He's asked twice, both times he doesn't have an answer. And Imogen says, tell someone who gives a fuck. She doesn't care. And so ostensibly, we never find out. But the implication from it cutting, and then so it cuts to the credits and music starts playing, and the implication is that that is the band, and it is Creedence Clearwater Revival, which is a great choice. They have so many amazing songs. But Jeremy Saulnier, again, he likes to keep things fun. He said that although that is a correct answer, he also whispered something to Anton Yelchin that only they knew. And so there is a secondary answer that I guess we'll never find out. But even if it is Creedence Clearwater Revival, that's an awesome choice. And
yeah, for sure.
It's a great band.
Yeah, it's awesome. It not only is it a fun plot, thread throughout, that kind of lightens the mood a little bit when some extremely disturbing and messed up shit is happening. Not only that, it's also part of thematically Anton Yelchin's character, who is this guy who fits in the pantheon of Jeremy Saulnier's, quote unquote, inept protagonists.
Yeah.
A guy who's not very assertive, a guy who doesn't really know exactly what he's doing, and he can't even make up his own mind about, what his Desert Island Band is. And after he goes through this entire experience and comes out the other side, he finally knows, but who gives a fuck?
Yeah, exactly. And just for those who were curious, Saulnier has said that his own answer would be Black Sabbath. So that's also great. I would personally go with Dio era, but no hate on Ozzy either.
Oh, no, God, no.
You mentioned that this humor sort of cuts the horrific, horrific violence that's happening in this movie. And there is a lot of dark humor in it. There's the owner's focus on fire hazards. They're warned about it by Macon Blair. He says, don't block the hallway, because he's a real stickler for fire hazards. And then later, when Patrick Stewart is walking down that hallway, there is gear in the hallway, and he says, that's a fire hazard.
Right.
it made
as they're playing, I'm murdering all these kids. Right.
Yep.
No, it's fantastic. One of the examples I really liked was right before they take the stage to play, Nazi punks fuck off. Yelchin starts getting cold feet, and he wants to back out. And Alia says, if you back out now, I'm going to tell him you're Jewish.
Yep. Yeah, it's really funny. It's all very dark humor. There's Macon Blair is power washing, and so he doesn't hear when someone calls him for help as they're being murdered, because he just has the water going. As Patrick Stewart is kicking people out so that they can handle this situation, he says, those of you attending the racial advocacy workshop on Wednesday, assume it's still on unless you hear otherwise. And that is – it's funny the way it's phrased, but like I said, that's sort of the kind of phrasing that makes it so horrific and realistic, is that that's a real thing, I bet, that happens. That
oh, for sure.
That they're like – It's a racial advocacy workshop. What the hell does that mean? That's how to convince people that the white race is superior. They cover things up. They obscure the real meaning in phrases like this to the point where people are like, well, I don't know what that even means, so who cares? When really, it's truly horrific shit.
Yeah, they expressly co-opt progressive terminology and obfuscate it so that they can pervert it to their own ends and can do it in broad daylight. And they don't trip up suspicion from the people that they should be getting suspicion from. Like, say, for instance, Mother Jones, who probably should not be doing another article about how dapper they all are.
Yes, I can't disagree with that. And that's only the beginning of it, because like we've already said, the violence in this is, frankly, grotesque. It's the only way I can put it.
Oh, man. No, it messed me up.
When Darcy, the owner of the club, comes in, that's Patrick Stewart, he manages to convince Anton Yelchin to hand over the gun that they have. Because he says that if you don't hand it over, we're going to kill you for sure. But if you give us the gun, that we just want that out of the picture because it's unregistered. And so we can start talking finally once that's out.
Right.
And he goes to hand them the gun. And they yank him out a little bit. They like grab him by the arm and they just start like chopping away at it. You don't see the actual chopping, but when he pulls back his arm into the room, it makes me queasy just thinking about it. It's so awful. Gross. The hand itself is like dangling from the thinnest strip of skin. It's totally chopped up, and to fix him, they tie a sweatshirt around it and duct tape it up, and that's how he is spending the rest of the movie, with his entire arm chopped to pieces, his hand literally dangling off. It's really disgusting, frankly.
Yeah, no, it's horrifying. It is realistic battle damage, and I do not do well with that. Neither did anyone else in the room I was watching the movie with. So, but I will say this right now, that he, you know, Saulnier does it judiciously, even though there are several examples throughout the movie of some really horrifying and gruesome, you know, practical effects that you're looking at. It's not every single kill or every single, you know, assault doesn't turn out that way. So I appreciate the fact that he uses it for punctuation and emphasis rather than just, you know, turning into like a Eli Roth movie or something.
Yeah, and I think another thing that sort of separates him from that level of Eli Roth, where it's violence for violence sake, is that it's all presented very flatly. It's not shiny blood flying everywhere. Like, you don't see any blood flying because you don't see the actual chopping. And he pulls it back, and it's just there. It's not...
It's curtains of meat.
Exactly. Yeah. It's very flat. It's very realistic. Like you said, it's actual battle damage. And it's something that I really appreciate in horror movies, because it makes it more real to me, which makes it much more scary.
Yeah, definitely. I know that Saulnier was... talking when we made the movie, what he was really interested in doing was portraying essentially a small core of civilian people up against a militarized, you know, group of soldiers essentially. And, you know, that's the main reason why he chose the neo-Nazi movement, because within the hardcore and punk scene, they were militarized, they were regimented, they had color coordination, they had drill, they had all sorts of things that kind of gave them that specific aura within the music scene. And in this particular case, kind of going back a little bit to the plot, after they're done with their set, they go back to the green room where they have all their stuff. And Anton Yelchin sees that the girl got murdered by some of the Nazis there. And as soon as he sees that, when they can't leave, so they get herded back into the green room. And from there, they have this base to work from. But there's a siege. You know, the Nazis are just outside the door. And
in the room with them, too.
There's one.
Big Justin.
Right. Yeah, they have a huge bouncer who is extremely badass and seems like a bit of a final boss himself in the room with them. But as you mentioned, they had a gun and they were able to kind of keep it trained on him to keep him behaving himself. But just outside the door is a whole, you know, army waiting to take them on. And they have to think their way out of this. And they're not really equipped to do it.
Yeah, it's a really frightening scenario for someone to find themselves in, especially, you know, these are clearly young people and going up against someone who's as cold and calculating, like I said, as Patrick Stewart's character is really intense.
Yeah, that's the whole back half of the movie too, is just them trying to figure out, you know, kind of testing boundaries and peeking their head out and trying to figure out different routes that they might be able to get this thing done, and they're just outlook is not good.
Yeah, that's putting it mildly, and it's rough. Like you said, they go in, they see this woman's been murdered, and that's another example of some pretty intense violence where the guy who kills her is part of the band Cowcatcher, and they're like, well, maybe she's not dead because there's not a lot of blood, and he literally drags her from the knife in her head. Like, he just holds that and pulls her across the floor, and the knife comes out and blood spills out, and they're like, oh, there it is. That's another example of sort of, here's this gross violence, and then boom, a little bit of humor to make you feel a little bit better about it.
Yeah, that was the amuse-bouche of violence.
Yes.
I saw that. Yeah, she's lying. After that, you know, this woman who's already dead is now lying in a pool of her own blood, and everybody's freaked out by it and crying, and I was just sort of like, oh, man, that's messed up. And then about 20 minutes later, you get the machete hacking on Anton Yelchin's arm. And then that was a whole new level, and I was like, oh god, I don't think I'm prepared for this.
it only descends from there. Like you said, they're trying to poke them a little bit, see how they can get out. That's their entire goal, is literally just to leave. That's right, all they survival. Want. Meanwhile, the Nazis are trying to figure out how they can stage it to make it look like the band was in the wrong. They don't want it to. They don't want the kill to be at the venue because they have a heroin lab in their basement. So they say, oh, that's what this is all about. It's not about us, really. It's about this heroin in here and blowing up their whole operation, because one can assume that that's how they're funding their themselves and their troops and everything. One by one, the group slowly gets sort of picked off as they make these escape attempts.
That's one of the areas that is incredible to me, is that there are some cliches in here that, you know, in most other movies, you're yelling at the TV screen, you know, the movie screen, like, what the hell are you doing? Don't do that. But in the context of what Sonya is doing here, it actually works. You know, their first foray out of the green room, you know, after Anton gets his arm chopped up, they're trying to figure out, okay, we got to get the hell out of here. And they just decide they're all going to rush at once. And as soon as they get out of the room, there's this compulsion to split up, just to try every route they can find to try to figure out everybody for themselves, basically. And right. Again, whereas, you know, you hear, let's split up in a horror movie, that's always your cue to, like, you know, throw popcorn at the screen. In this case, you're like, no, split up, go, like, get the hell out of here.
That's right. And unfortunately, they do get picked off. The violence continues. Tiger gets his throat ripped out by an attack dog. So, and like a full few seconds, you just look at him gurgling there.
Great practical effect. Also devastating to look at. Great ironic death with the lead singer getting his throat torn out by a vicious dog. But yeah, it is super visceral. And it's also happening while, you know, Joe Cole finds a window to crawl out of somewhere else in the building. And as soon as he's like half of his body's out the window, he sees they're already waiting for him with knives, and they just stab the shit out of him.
Yeah.
It's a lot to have happen at once.
Exactly. Yeah. These things are literally happening simultaneously, and you're not even finished reacting to the first death before the second one is happening. It's really intense. Again, it's that high intensity, very quick, frenetic energy, and it's really powerful in this situation. As they make their way back to the green room and they're
regrouping. I got to give a shout out real quick before we move to that. I got to give a shout out to Alia grabbing the fire extinguisher, and she uses it to very good effect to, you know, keep guys off of her. So while everybody else has like edged weapons or, you know, trying to use a bludgeon or something like that, she has a fire extinguisher that she's spraying on her attackers, and it makes them back right off. I have personal experience with this. I had some friends who thought it'd be very funny to spray a mutual friend in while he was in the shower with a fire extinguisher, and it nearly killed him. It just took like all the oxygen out of the room. It was a very enclosed space. It was like it was pretty horrific, and nobody had any idea. So ever since then, I was like, oh, that's actually a pretty effective anti-attacker weapon.
Joe, this is going to be really bizarre, but coincidentally, I have a very similar experience.
Oh, God. We're all men.
Yes. when I was in college, none of us had ever seen what happens in real life when you shoot off a fire extinguisher. Mm-hmm. And so we thought, well, we got to find out, right? And so we all crowded into our tiny little dorm room.
Oh, my God.
And we sprayed it off, and it really shot out a lot quicker than we anticipated. And it goes everywhere, and people are, like, fumbling for the door, and people's noses start bleeding, including mine. It's really intense. And so, for sure, if you have a fire extinguisher near you and you're being attacked, it's a valuable weapon.
Yes. At least there was something good about being a dude in your 20s and extremely stupid. You and I both learned how to protect ourselves.
That's right. That's right. Another instance of the violence is Daniel, the cousin that we mentioned before, who they were sent there to see by Tad, the journalist. It turns out that he was planning on leaving the Nazi group with Emily, the girl who got murdered. So he sort of joins their group. And he says that he knows how to get out of there.
He gets sent in by Patrick Stewart to basically finish him off.
Yes.
Along with one other dude from the neo-Nazi group. And when he gets in there, obviously all he's concerned about finding out is what happened to his girlfriend. And when he finds out she got murdered, Imogen Poots tells him, like, do you really want me to tell you why he got murdered in front of this other, you know, jackass over here in front of the other neo-Nazi? And tells him, like, yeah, they knew you were going to leave, or they knew she was going to leave, but she didn't give you up. So now all of a sudden he is faced, you know, his betrayal is now known by the neo-Nazis. He sends that cohort guy away, and at that point just decides he's going to cast his lot with the band in the green room.
And this is another example of the seed that is planted earlier in the movie, because as soon as they get to the venue, they start asking him, like, oh, are you Cousin Dan? And he says, Daniel. And
right.
They say, oh, when you go up there with your girl, speaking about Tads, he really quickly shuts them down. He's like, don't talk about that. Like, don't talk about her.
Right, don't and talk so, about my girl, yeah.
Yeah, and so you're, like, wondering, well, is it just because he's a psychopath? or, like, what? Like, what's the deal with this?
And yeah, it definitely just comes off as garden variety menacing. Yes. And then, yeah, like you say, you find out later.
Yeah, you find out that he was planning on leaving and that they were going to escape together. And so it's just another example of really solid payoff. And you're like, great, Daniel's on the team. They're finally going to get out. We're going to have a happy ending after all. He says, luckily, I know where the – and the implication is that he is going to pull out a shotgun. And instead, he takes a thing of buckshot to the face. It literally blows off the entire half of his face. And the stand-in bartender from the Nazis says, too slow. It's just brutal.
As he exits the picture, I just want to say Cousin Daniel is Mark Weber. Shout out to him. It took me forever to figure out where I know him from. He was Stephen Stills in Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
He sure was.
Man, what a difference 5 years makes. Very different roles. But
yeah
it's great, this wonderful.
Both great punk performances in Scott Pilgrim and in this, though.
Yeah, for sure. He definitely has a type, and it's sort of quiet but grungy-looking dude who gets things done. And he really makes you feel like he is going to get things done in this movie. You finally have somebody, you know, from the neo-Nazis from the inside who was looking to switch anyway. Now he's on the good guys team, and now there's some hope. And like you said, George, you know, he's there for all of 5 minutes as he's, you know, walking toward where the shotgun should be, steps in, another neo-Nazi, got the drop on him, blows his head off, and it is very gruesome.
Yeah, and then they are finally dealing with that again. They are trying to get out one more time. They flee back to the green room. More Nazis come in, including the neo-Nazi who discovered Daniel's betrayal. And it's obvious that at this point that they need to set a trap because they cannot just keep getting picked off like this. So Anton Yelchin finishes his story about paintball that he started earlier in the movie and says that we can't be worried about it. We got to just go for it, because if we're too worried, their tactics will overwhelm us. We need to just make our move. And
right,
so,
you can't fight on their terms. They are trained. They are soldiers. They are regimented. We are not. And if we try to, you know, engage by their rules of engagement, we're going to get wasted. If we go crazy and we do things that are unpredictable, and if we just are a complete chaotic mess, you know, that's what's going to be able to defeat those kinds of tactics.
To that end, Anton Yelchin lures them into the green room, and he escapes down the hole into the heroin lab. And one of the neo-Nazis, there are two who've been sent in, one of the neo-Nazis follows him down. Meanwhile, as the other one is watching his back, we see Imogen crawl out from inside of the couch with face paint on and just slices the guy's throat with a box cutter that they got from Big Justin earlier in the movie. And you're like, wow, great plan, genuinely. It was so surprising and fun to see her crawl out of there that first time. And the more you watch it, the more you're like, yes, this is the only way that this could have worked.
Yeah, no, it's great. They, you know, the way that they decide that they're going to go crazy and really go with chaotic, not you just can't call it really planning, but it is a bit of a plan amidst the chaos. He's somehow shaved his head. I don't know where he got the clippers, but Anton Yelchin has much shorter hair. They've painted their face. They just look crazy. And as soon as they come in, he's speaking gibberish at the bad guys and hots down a little hidey hole so that they're so focused on him, they don't notice the excellent slow reveal of her slowly coming out of the couch, unbeknownst to the guy left up top in the green room. So, yeah, like you said, it's fantastic to watch. Really, but still, you know, everybody up to this point has been getting picked off really easily. And I definitely had zero confidence that he wasn't going to, like, turn around and see her and, you know, off her as well. So that tension's still there.
Yeah, this is really their first win.
Yeah, totally.
And it's so far into the movie. It's like I said, it's a 95-minute movie. That's probably at like minute 70 that they finally get their first victory.
Yeah, and realistically too, you know, the only reason they're even able to win is because at this point the siege has been going on for so long and they've already picked off so many members of the band. There's only two people left. You know, at this point, Patrick Stewart's told everybody to go home, basically. You guys go home. You know, a bunch of you come with me. We're going to go finish the staging 6 miles up the road where we can put all these bodies to make it look like it was a trespassing accident. So everybody's left, and they've only left behind these two, you know, two yokels to try to take out the remaining two band members who are already pretty beat up. Well, yeah. One band member in Imogen Poots. So right. The only reason they're even able to get the drop on these guys is because there's really nobody left to back them up.
Yeah, Patrick Stewart, he says that if we call this in too late, then it's already over. Right. So luckily they're sort of hold out until things turn in their favor. Plan has worked in a way in that it has certainly driven the Nazis to make mistakes because they need to make sure that things are going to go the way that they want. And like you said, they send in these two who are definitely on the younger side. They get the drop on them. And finally, they also kill the last guy as well.
Right.
And they walk out and get the drop on the three people who are out in the main area. They're sort of the big bads of the group. There's the owner of the fighting dogs.
Very importantly, before we even get to that part, you know, they get the drop on the two guys in the heroin lab thanks to their chaos plan. But then when they emerge, they see Macon Blair, you know, power washing the bar. And he knows, he can see, you know, at this point they have guns. Imogen's got, I believe, is a shotgun.
Yes.
And Anton's got a handgun. And, you know, Macon kind of doesn't realize until too late that they've emerged from the green room, you know, with weapons. And he gives it up immediately. As we mentioned before, he's not even really a true believer of this organization. He's felt really conflicted throughout. He just wants to get the hell out of here. And they basically tell him, you go get the cops and get them here. We're going to go continue on. And yeah. Find the rest of these guys.
And you watch him just walk away, and it's you're like
totally unclear whether he's going to follow through. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
but you're glad that at least it seems possible that he is redeemable.
Right.
So they go up the road to where the staging is happening, and there's the owner of the dogs, there's Patrick Stewart, and there's one guy who was driving them. Anton Yelchin holds the driver at gunpoint. He convinces him to throw him his gun, or he throw the gun away at least, because right. In what is a fun line that sort of is indicative of just how little shits he has left to give, he says, give me your gun. And the guy says, I don't have one. And he says, if you don't hand me a gun, whether you have one or not, I'm going to shoot you. And he's just so done. And so yeah. I think it's very visible in the physical acting in addition to the verbal acting. And the Nazi does indeed throw the gun away. And Imogen shoots the owner of the dogs. Things start to escalate. And this other driver Nazi, he gets shot as well. And
tries to make
finally,
a move to their guns. Yeah.
Yes. And finally, Patrick Stewart, he starts walking away.
He just starts walking away. It's great. Like, he's just, yeah. Like, hurriedly, just like, I'm out. I'm leaving. Let's just see what happens. And he starts pulling a gun out. And Imogen shoots him, I think, in the leg, yeah?
Yeah. She gets him in the leg. And he starts to turn around so that he can shoot at them with this gun that is actually the gun that Anton handed over earlier in the movie. That was a gift, as he so eloquently put before. And Anton Yelchin takes one last shot, and it just pops him in the head. And it's actually the least explicit violence maybe in the entire movie. There's yeah. Like one squirt of blood, but that's it. He just drops.
Yeah.
He shoots. Yeah, Patrick Stewart gets a shot off. It misses both of them, leaves a huge bullet hole. It's obviously a huge caliber bullet in some generator or something. But he just drops. The threat is over as far as they're concerned. And it's a really unspectacular ending in a good way. It feels, again, very real, where it's not like this huge shootout at the very end. They get right. The bad guy, and then they just sit there to wait for the cops that they sent Macon Blair to go find.
Yeah, it feels a lot like catharsis after, whether it's performance or whether you go to a show, you know, you have that huge high energy burst of the actual performance, and then there's the come down afterward. And this is kind of what that feels like. You know, the final shot with Patrick Stewart, as you said, is pretty unspectacular. His death is not in any way gruesome or gory compared to the other ones, at least in this movie. And then one of the final shots right after he goes down, you know, Yelchin and Imogen Poots sit down, they're so exhausted, and here comes one of the attack dogs, and instead of going after them, the attack dog just goes to where its, you know, now dead master is laying. And just lays down and puts his head on him. And
yeah,
it's,
and they're holding the guns and they're ready, but they're clearly so exhausted. It's the guns are like drooping in their hands, and it's such a relief that this dog ignores them.
Yeah, definitely. So it fits that sort of thematic journey, I guess. And like I said earlier, Saulnier is like putting the experience both metaphorically and you know, explicitly on the screen. So it's very cool to see. And it also, like, I don't know about you, man, but I was definitely tired out. This movie, like you said, does not overstay its welcome. It's very, very tight, but it was just exhausting in a very good way.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely draining because you're so invested and it does have those quick bursts of energy that you're on the edge of your seat for.
Totally.
So we've reached the end of the movie, the best horror movie ever made. So Joe, why is it that? Why is this Green Room by Jeremy Saulnier, 2015, the best horror movie ever made?
Well, I'm going to go with the sort of the quicker, easier reasons first, because, you know, in this day and age, having something that is so tightly paced and so tightly packaged and doesn't overstay its welcome is a huge blessing. Anytime you go to the theaters now, you are risking really being there for about a week. So the fact that this movie does what it does so effectively and so quickly is something I really appreciate. I appreciate, like I've been saying throughout, all the different ways that, you know, the movie has carried its themes and metaphors so easily and with aplomb. But ultimately, for me, one of the biggest reasons, aside from the fact it's entertaining, it's good, that it's one of the best movies, if not the best movie I've seen in the horror genre, is that all the best movies are about something. Classically, you have Dawn of the Dead, has a lot of satire on consumerism.
Right.
You have a lot of different examples throughout horror's history of trying to put some messaging inside the package, even going, you know, something as simple as Bram Stoker's Dracula essentially just being about a Victorian dude really wanting to write about sex. So they're all about something, the best examples in the genre. And this movie, I think, ends up being something, even though it didn't necessarily intend to be. You know, Saulnier is on the record as saying he didn't choose the Nazis because of their ideology, but because of how they are a soldier-like group within the music scene. But he made this movie, it was in production in, 2014, to be released in 2015. And times have changed a little bit. Yeah. Obviously, you know, as you mentioned before, white supremacy has been around for forever. The neo-Nazi movement's been hiding in plain sight for forever. But I think we have a very different era right now where, again, it's on your front page of your newspaper. It's on the news every night. And they are increasingly being normalized within American culture, at the very least. So what I really appreciate about this movie is, whether it intended to or not, here it is in 2019. You have an example, a portrayal of this ideology that is, they are the villain. There is no two questions about it. You may have sympathetic characters within that movement, but the movement itself is evil. And by the end of it, you are rooting for every last of those goddamn Nazis to take another machete to the face.
That's right.
And I feel like it's definitely a movie of the moment, whether it meant to be or not.
I couldn't agree more. To me, this is the best horror movie ever made because it, like you said, it's only become increasingly relevant. It's a tour de force of acting from one of our greatest young stars, Anton Yelchin, who, like I said, unfortunately taken too soon. It does have this story about Nazis. They are absolutely, they're scum. They're the villains. They're evil.
Right.
They are straight up evil.
Yeah.
It's also, I want to give credit and talk a little bit about the distribution company and production company. This is right at the beginning of A24's taking the wheel of horror these days. A24 has really done an awesome job of picking scripts to distribute. The only straight-up horror movie prior to Green Room that they had distributed was The Witch, which is an amazing movie. But since then, they've put out The Black Coat's Daughter, The Monster, It Comes at Night, The Killing of a Sacred Deer, Hereditary, Midsommar. These movies, A24 is huge right now.
And yeah, they're killing it.
And it's sort of a different style of horror. It's a lot of these movies where they are for sure horror. They kind of avoid the issue that a lot of modern horror has, where people are afraid to call good movies horror movies.
Right.
Happened with Get Out, where people are like, oh, it's not a horror movie. Yes, it is. It's a horrific situation. It's absolutely a horror movie. But when a horror movie has something to say, people seem to be afraid to call it a horror movie because they think that it's elevated out of the genre. And I don't think that's the case.
Yeah, no, horror is definitely a genre that has been marginalized. I mean, it has been throughout its existence. Obviously, some creators like Jordan Peele, like Jeremy Saulnier, and, you know, in the literary world, guys like, you know, Stephen King are starting to get recognition for being horror writers, but or horror producers or movie makers. But also being great artists in their own right and not having, you know, being condescended to because they happen to work in a certain genre.
Yeah, absolutely. And so on top of all that, for it to take place in this very realistic and grounded way and still conjure this feeling of terror and dread, and there's so much tension in this movie throughout the whole thing. When they first find Emily, who's been murdered, and everyone is just standing in the green room looking at each other, waiting for something to happen, like, you're holding your breath the entire time. It's so tense. It's so brutal, and the violence, like we said, is grotesque, but in a way that really makes you feel it and it feels real.
That right, they could not do exploitative.
That. Yeah, exactly. It's not exploitative. The fact that they could do that without having to go with this grandiose supernatural villains or anything, that it's these Nazis who are absolutely the villain. That makes it the best horror movie of all time to me.
Yeah, for sure. You know that Patrick Stewart probably would cast his lot in there as well, because you know, he said when he read the script, he got about halfway through and then locked up his house and had to pour himself some scotch. So pretty good indicator.
And you know what? I'm right there with you, Patrick. You know, get me. I'm locked up. Get me some scotch right now. Joe, I had a great time chatting with you about this. I want to thank you for coming on. And I wanted to give you a chance to plug anything, if you had anything to plug.
Oh, man, this was a ton of fun. Thank you so much for having me on. I do have a Twitter account. Do not follow it. It is JC_ESQ. Seriously, I only basically tweet enough about politics to piss off people who love sports and enough about sports to piss off people who like politics. So save yourself the search. Don't do it.
Well, I'm right in the Venn diagram of people who that Twitter account is perfect for. Joe's a great follow. Don't listen to him. Follow him on Twitter. He's great. You can find me on Twitter at Gerg Heff, and you can follow the podcast Twitter at Little Horror PHL. And you can follow along on Letterboxd as well. We have a list where we keep track of the movies that we've watched. They are all the best horror movie ever made. And we leave reviews. Let us know what you think of these movies. You can reach out on Twitter or Letterboxd, leave a comment. We hope to hear from you. And thanks, everyone, for listening. And thanks again, Joe, for being our guest today.
Yeah, thanks, everybody.